In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. A big thank you to listeners for supporting WBAI during the past fundraiser and also supporting this show. I appreciate it, and it tells me that you're interested in the topics that are being covered on In Other News. There is an ancient set of equations and formulas that determine where cathedrals, monuments, and arenas are placed. In past shows, this analysis included an understanding of telluric currents that are carried by ley lines. Primary past guest on this topic, Peter Shampoo, author of Gaia Matrix, says electromagnetic energy is carried by telluric currents. Peter used the word matrix in the title of his book, and it's appropriate, especially when you break down the sacred geometry within key structures and their relative locations on the planet. Our guest author and filmmaker, Scott Onstott, has produced a documentary series titled Secrets in Plain Sight, which explores patterns in art, architecture, urban design, and the cosmos. For example, the particular measurements and ratios of the Earth, Sun, and Moon have a sacred geometry and numerological pattern that has influenced architecture and design throughout the ages. Scott is the author of many books, including Taking Measure, Explorations in Number, Architecture, and Consciousness. The book reveals patterns emergent in our universe from quantum to astronomic scales. Scott asks if these patterns emerge by pure coincidence. Has it been done to preserve knowledge, or is it an ancient form of magic that continues to this day? Are the synchronicities we experience in our personal lives manifestations of these same patterns? Scott has a degree in architecture from the University of California at Berkeley. He has written 9 technical books on architectural design and visualization software. He offers training videos on AutoCAD, Photoshop, and creates digital art based on number and sacred geometry. Scott, welcome to Another News.
Thanks a lot. Nice to be here with you, Jeff.
Let's start with a section in your documentary, Secrets in Plain Sight, about New York City. You connect the U-shaped area in the White House backyard, then comparing it with the blue stone ring at Stonehenge. There's a large rectangle base at Stonehenge that can also be divided into 2 triangles. But from that point on, you found interesting spatial connections to New York City. Can you talk about this part of the documentary?
Yes. What you're mentioning there is there's a rectangle around the White House, and there's also a station rectangle in Stonehenge that share the same proportions. It's a 5 to 12 rectangle. And interestingly enough, Central Park is 2 of those rectangles put side by side. So it would be 5 by 24. And the basis of this is 2 triangles that go together, a 5, 12, 13 Pythagorean triangle. That 2 of those fit together and they make this 5 by 12 rectangle. And in my documentary, I show how that the earliest example I found, other than Stonehenge, was the old part of Jerusalem. So the sacred geometry of Jerusalem also has that same proportion. And then I was blown away to discover that the dollar bill also has that same proportion, more or less.
You mean the shape of the currency itself?
Yeah, exactly.
You drew a line from Stonehenge to New York, and it bisected Central Park.
Yeah, actually, the line goes from Stonehenge to the tip of the Federal Triangle in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And that line is actually a great circle arc. Like if you connect the 2 points in Google Earth and then you go to New York City, you'll see that the line bisects Central Park. And in such a way that really drew my attention to that park. And then it led me on to this underwater structure in the lake there. And it led me to the Egyptian temple inside the Met, and it just keeps going. I think in the documentary, it just one thing leads to another, and I kind of go on this world tour of cities connected through symbolism.
Absolutely. It was very interesting. You connected into Cleopatra's Needle in Central Park. I don't think a lot of people know that there is a, I think the ancient Temple of Dendera, parts of it are in that museum. But you drew the line from the Jackie Onassis Reservoir, and there's an aqueduct, which I didn't really know about, crossing the reservoir, and that was pointing to the museum, specifically where the Egyptian ruins are being held.
Yeah, and that aqueduct, as I called it, seems to be the mirror image of the line that we just described that ran from D.C. to Stonehenge. And so I was like, oh, there's a symmetry there, you know? Then I look inside the Sackler Wing of the Met, and there's that ancient Egyptian temple that was moved there when they flooded, when they built the Aswan Dam. It flooded an area, and the government of Egypt donated it to the U.S. And they also, at the same time, put other temples. There's one in Madrid and a couple others in the world. And, you know, each one of those is got fascinating symbolism as well. Yeah, the ancient Egypt is really a fascinating subject, and it seems like a lot of the symbolism in the cities kind of ties back to that. Like in San Francisco, I found this nine-sided polygon that maps onto the streets and onto Treasure Island there. And that kind of resonates with the Ennead, the group of nine gods that was venerated at Heliopolis. So there's like this deep kind of Egyptian connection running through my work and my research.
Coming back to New York City for a minute, the obelisk was very interesting. A lot of listeners may also know that there's a similar obelisk in London called Cleopatra's Needle. Why do you think they were specifically placed in those areas?
Well, they were kind of Freemasonic projects moved to London and New York City. And they were quite the engineering challenge to transport such a heavy stone. It's really amazing. And there's a book called, I think it's called Magic of the Obelisks by Peter Tompkins that goes into that. It's fascinating. But what I found with Cleopatra's Needle in London might bear repeating here. I looked at where it used to be in Alexandria and where it is now, and I just measured the distance between those points. So it was in Alexandria for about 2,000 years, and prior to that, it was in Heliopolis. But nevertheless, I went from Alexandria to London, from where it was to where it is, and the distance is 3,333.3 kilometers, which I just thought is too amazing to be an accident, you know? But if you think about that deeper, it couldn't really just be a Freemasonic conspiracy to place the obelisk there, because what are the chances that London would be in a place where that could even happen?
Yes, and that's interesting as well. You mentioned in Taking Measure in your book how there are original points placed in the city of London, but they were originally placed there by the Romans. They created the original layout. And do you think that has something to do with it?
Yeah, I've actually been to the London Stone. It's just like this unassuming monument on a street there in London. And it's sort of like the what do they call it? The umbilicus urbis Romae. There's like a naval stone in Rome as well. And the one in London acted in the same fashion in that it was like the origin point of their geospatial coordinate system. And it seems to be at the base of this street pyramid in London. So really centrally, you know, located. And I believe the Bank of England is right there at the top of the pyramid of streets in London. So just really fascinating symbolism there. And I went into the Bank of England, went into this impressive structure and look at the floor, and there's this hermetic kind of caduceus inlaid in tile on the floor. It's a caduceus. It's a symbol of a staff with serpents intertwined, wrapped around the staff. It's kind of a symbol of the human energy field of like the Ida and Pingala running up the human spine. So it's sort of this deep understanding of the subtle energy system in the body represented there in the floor of the Bank of England. And I just thought, wow, there's somebody that understands some esoteric matters here. You know, or maybe they did when they put that down quite a long time ago.
And that it was preserved.
Yes, still there. The mother of all banks, similar to the Federal Reserve Bank in the U.S., the central bank.
And London is a city within a city, I do believe?
The city of London is, and just like you have UN headquarters in New York City being kind of a city within a city, it's an extra national zone. And like the Vatican is within Rome as well.
And we'll come back to that because you point out spherical sculptures at the sphere within a sphere on the property of the United Nations. You may have heard about the morning talk show host who was dressed up as a Statue of Liberty who fainted during a live television broadcast on Halloween. And the Statue of Liberty has a lot of deep symbolic resonance. Can you go over some of your findings about this colossus and its foundation?
Sure. So it was laid down and it was put there in a Freemasonic ceremony, but the sculpture itself was designed by Bartholdi, who was a Freemason, and he originally designed it for the Suez Canal. But political events caused that not to happen, so it was donated to the United States. And originally, he sculpted it to represent the goddess Isis, and then to sort of rebranded it as Liberty later on. So I just thought that was fascinating. And then the seven rays on the crown of the Statue of Liberty are kind of an interesting choice, seven. And then it stands on a base star. Like the fortifications have 11 points. So there's this 7 to 11 symbolism, which is the proportion of the Great Pyramid's height to base width. And so it has this other layer of Egyptian symbolism representing the Great Pyramid and the goddess Isis that are there encoded in that. And also the Statue of Liberty is a lighthouse, isn't it? It's got this torch at the top. And so it is kind of a symbol of illumination. And I did this analysis of it. I got the official elevation of the statue, and I put a golden rectangle over it. And I found kind of amazingly that when you size the golden rectangle so that the top of it's right at the tip of the torch and the bottom of it is right at the base where the metal, the base of the metal sculpture. Well, the convergence point of the spiral goes right into the third eye of the statue. So I thought that has to be intentional as well.
Did you diagram that in the documentary?
No, that's something I did more recently. I'd be happy to send that to you. It's hard to paint that picture in words. It's much easier just to see it visually.
The 7-11 ratio also corresponds to the name of the convenience store, 7-11. And do you think that's coincidental?
I do. I think a lot of these things are so-called coincidences, but there seems to be like a deeper order to reality that I kind of tap into from time to time in my research. And I speculate that there is really no such thing as a coincidence. Everything is like deeply planned at some amazing level of reality. My first job was working at a 7-Eleven, incidentally.
How long were you there?
Oh, I was only there for a summer. Yeah, when I was a teenager.
Oh, I see. I think that's a tough job working in those stores. How was it? Did you enjoy it?
It was tough. I think I just spent all the money I earned went into buying music and gasoline. I remember that.
Well, Scott, you know, you moved on to bigger and better things. And in your book, Taking Measure, Explorations in Number, Architecture, and Consciousness, you mention how American units of measurement, such as a foot, are not arbitrary lengths and have connections to the distant past. Could you tell listeners how you arrived at this understanding?
Well, there's actually multiple layers of measurement that kind of I can paint a picture for you. And the first thing I found was in a book by John Michel and Robin Heath, and it's called The Lost Science of Measuring the Earth. And they find that the English foot comes from a very simple equation. It's the number of days in a year times the number of degrees in a circle times 1,000. And that equals the number of feet in the Earth's equatorial circumference. And it's really very, very accurate. It's 99.99% accurate. So it seems like whoever designed the English foot in the distant past must have encoded the concept of the circle and the concept of the year, which is a kind of circle, into this unit. And I just thought that was really beautiful because the system comes right out of measuring the Earth. And then later on, after I had made my Secrets in Plain Sight film, a fan contacted me. His name was Lawrence Edlund, and he came up with the following statement, and that is, the inch is to the mile as the astronomical unit is to the light year. And I think that's 99.9% accurate. So it's really kind of fascinating to me that these imperial units have a cosmic resonance, as well as they're not necessarily just arbitrary units. There's a third level, a third connection I can share with you, and that has to do with the comparison of mile and inch again. So it turns out that there are 63,360 inches in a mile. That is, if you just multiply 5,280 feet times 12 inches in a foot, you get 63,360. Well, so what? Well, it turns out that there's 63,360 furlongs in the Earth's diameter. So furlongs are part of this imperial system, even though we don't tend to use that unit very much these days. It is still part of the same interlocking system. And then if you take the combined Earth and Moon diameters and set that equal to a radius of a circle, well, the circumference of the circle would be 63,360 miles. So we have these different resonances between the units in the imperial system, indicating a deep understanding of these cosmic patterns. So that I think that there's a greater intelligence at work there. It's not random. It's not just an arbitrary measurement, but these units are chosen with a very deep understanding that came first.
Even the metric system and standard units of measurement have correspondence to each other in maybe the sacred geometry, and you start to examine various distances and lengths in addition to the units of measurement. Did you find that as apparent?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, measurement is sort of a key into the mysteries. And if you have a mind for detail like I do, then it's sort of irresistible to explore that whole realm and see how this fits together.
Back to New York for a minute, I noticed that the two massive piers of the George Washington Bridge seem to have the Tree of Life embedded in the metal truss work in the arch. I sent you a picture of it. What are your thoughts on this potential symbolism in plain sight?
Yeah, I see it there, and it's like something that has plausible deniability. You could look at it and say, oh, there's nothing to that. But that tends to be the way that secrets in plain sight manifest. You can look at them and say, oh, there's nothing to that, move along. Or you can actually perceive the amazing pattern that is there and say, oh my God, that's the Tree of Life. You know, it's right there. And it reminds me of the Tree of Life that was designed by two different architects for the rebuilding of the City of London after the fire of 1666. And I saw another amazing Tree of Life in the recent London Olympics. In the opening ceremony, they had this Glastonbury Tor and a tree on top of it, and all the people were standing in such a way that it was obviously a Tree of Life. And you just have to wonder, you know, about who was designing that ceremony and if they were aware of that or not. But nevertheless, there was the pattern. And it's just like one of those moments when you go, yes, I see it. That's awesome. You know, and how did you feel when you saw that bridge, when you perceived that pattern? Were you amazed?
I was on a motorcycle, and for some reason, I glanced up, and I thought, wow, that looks like the Kabbalah Tree of Life. And I'm thinking to myself, no, my brain is making patterns where there might not be any. And I kept going, but it stuck with me until I got home and I looked it up online. And sure enough, it certainly looks like it to me.
I agree. I mean, you could also read it as just the structural diagram that was necessary to hold that thing together. But why did it have to end up really looking like a tree of life? It makes you wonder about whether that was planned or if that's just like something that happens.
Well, we do know that George Washington was one of the primary Freemasons that's often celebrated in various Masonic halls across the country. Kind of makes sense that there might be, you know, symbols embedded in the structure of a bridge that's named after George Washington.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's there. Yeah.
And you examine the symbols of Freemasonry, the culture, the architecture, and mystery traditions of ancient Egypt. They're often referenced. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the influence of ancient Egyptian culture on Freemasonry.
Well, some scholars connect the rituals of Freemasonry with the stories in ancient Egypt. And it doesn't seem like there's an unbroken chain of descent of that knowledge. But I know like Graham Hancock and Robert Vival wrote a book called Talisman, and they attempted to trace that lineage through history. And there are many different kind of custodians of the knowledge. And I know Robert Lomas and Christopher Knight wrote a book called The Hiram Key that traces that the stories of Freemasonry really are echoes of this Egyptian king, Sekenenre Tau, the second, I believe he is, who died in a similar manner to the Hiram Abiff story. I mean, it really makes sense that Freemasonry is sort of an echo of an ancient Egyptian mystery school. We're just getting bits and pieces of it now, and the knowledge is sort of fragmented. And so we can't definitively say, yeah, that was just passed down directly. But we get like kind of flavors of it that make you really wonder how old these stories really are, you know?
They seem to go back thousands and thousands of years. Scott, I'd like to go through a few sacred numbers you list in your book, Taking Measure, and if you could talk about some of their deep relational structure within our reality. One of the numbers is 273, that corresponds with squaring the circle. I sent you an image of a sculpture in front of the Harriman Bank across from Zuccotti Park that has a cube with a circle inside of it. I suspect that's based on the squaring the circle principle, but can you talk about that number, 273?
Sure. So this number is it comes right out of squaring the circle, and if you're not familiar with that, briefly, it is taking the perimeter of a square and setting it equal to the circumference of a circle. And this is something that geometers have been striving to do for thousands of years, literally. And it also comes from an even simpler arrangement of just simply inscribing a circle inside a square so that the circle is tangent to that square at four points. If you look at the area of the square, it's 27.3% larger than the area of the circle. And if you square the circle, then the diameter of the circle is 1.273 times the edge length of the square, which would be 1. And so these numbers just kind of pop out, 1.273 or 27.3%. And it makes me think, oh, the moon, the moon's sidereal cycle is 27.3 days. That is the time that it takes to do one orbit of the Earth against the background of fixed stars. And it's funny, but the human menstrual cycle is 27.3 days on average, and human gestation is 273 days, or 10 times that menstrual cycle. So our bodies are just perfectly tuned to the moon and to this very simple geometry as well. And isn't it interesting that water turns from frozen to liquid at 273 degrees Kelvin? And also the background radiation left over from the Big Bang is measured at 2.73 degrees Kelvin. So all of these coincidences use the same numbers. And I just find that fascinating.
I do too. It's when you start to list all the significant proportions, the larger pattern comes out. But I remember being dismayed by the squaring of the circle, and I applied sort of a negative connotation of taking a natural edgeless shape and forcing people into square boxes and right angles, 90-degree angles, because we don't live in those structures, most of us don't. We're in squares, we're in right angles, we're in boxes in terms of classroom and offices. I kind of applied a negativity to it, where maybe things would be a little different if we had less right angles in our environment.
Well, it can be a bit overwhelming to be forced into these boxes. But I think that one reason geometers have been trying to square the circle is because the circle is like the most beautiful two-dimensional form. It's the most perfect. And in a way, it kind of represents like the celestial or the transcendental qualities. And then the square is the most familiar to us. It's the easiest shape that we have to divide land or to cut up properties or to divide rooms. And so it's just a very practical form. But if we're stuck in the boxes all the time, we sort of yearn for its opposite being a circle. And so the passion to square the circle is to somehow bring those two opposites into some kind of reconciliation. And it was proven in the 19th century that doing that exactly is impossible, because pi is not something that you can ever rationalize. But nevertheless, geometers still strive to make approximations for this, because it's really part of the human soul, trying to bring together the transcendental with the mundane and try to reconcile them in some way.
Our guest is Scott Onstott, author of Taking Measure, Explorations in Number, Architecture, and Consciousness. We'll be right back after this break. If you're just tuning in, our guest is author and filmmaker Scott Onstott. He's produced a documentary series titled Secrets in Plain Sight. There's another couple of numbers. Maybe we'll get through some of these. 153.
It's one of my favorites, yeah. So 153 is quoted in the Bible. I think it was in John 21, about 153 fishes that were caught in a net. And, you know, biblical scholars are like, why is it why do they count 153? You know, what's so important about that? Well, it turns out that the way that you can rationalize the vesica piscis form, which is kind of the first movement in sacred geometry, it's when you take two circles and you put one circle's center on the other circle's circumference. And it creates this kind of almond shape in the middle. I'm sure you're familiar with that. Mm-hmm. But that form can be rationalized by saying that the height of it is 265 and the width is 153. And these are the first integers that really work with that. And when you do the math, it's 99.997% accurate. So 153 is really key there. But then also, if you take the square root of 153, it's about 12.369, which is the number of full moons in a year. So it has this resonance with our celestial cycle as well. There's 153 sculptures around St. Peter's Square, and there are the holy name of God occurs 153 times in the book of Genesis. So there's this kind of numeric encoding in the religious text, and you'll find this to be true in many different religions, not just Christianity, that numbers are really deeply embedded in the traditions. Like there are 33 devas in Hinduism, and in the Mahabharata there are 33,333 gods. And Jesus lived 33 and a third years and performed 33 miracles. Like, what's up with that?
33 vertebrae in the spine?
That's right. And there are so many other 33s. I can go off on those and explore those if you'd like.
Sure. Let's go with that number for a bit.
Yeah, 33 is one of my favorites as well. So there's 33 octaves between the Schumann resonance and middle C, which is kind of the middle point of our hearing. The Schumann resonance is the Earth's natural resonance that results from lightning discharges in the atmosphere. Escape velocity, that is the speed that you have to go to leave the Earth, is 33 times the speed of sound. And the Kármán line, which is the border, they call it the edge of space, it's really the transition between aeronautics and astronautics, happens at 333,333 feet, more or less. So there's all these 33s, and to me, 33 represents the full range. It's like the maximum value in a way. When you reach 33, you've done the whole bit. For example, there are 33 orders of magnitude from absolute zero temperature to the Planck temperature, which is the temperature of the Big Bang. 33 orders of magnitude there. So it's like the full spectrum. You know, there's 33 degrees in the temperature scale made by Isaac Newton. He was the first one to make a temperature scale. Why did he pick 33 degrees? I'm not sure, but he seemed to be right on that with his intuition. And in Scottish Freemasonry, there are, you guessed it, 33 degrees. So it represents the full range.
You were also looking at White Sands, the launch pad.
Launch Complex 33, which is where they started the space program in the United States. They started experimenting with the V2 rocket, actually, with the Nazi scientists there. And what's amazing is that that's the only launch pad that they have in the whole area. And why did they call it Launch Complex 33? I don't know. Also at Cape Canaveral, there's a single runway there. It's called Runway 33.
Right, I saw that. You write, it's important to realize that Nazis, NASA, Disney, Freemasons, the U.S. government, the Federal Reserve, billionaires, Judeo-Christianity, the United Nations, and other entities that are trying to control the world do not own 33. 33 is a number that belongs to everyone. That's mm-hmm. an interesting point. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sometimes people will start to get freaked out about conspiracies, and they'll think, oh, they've ruined it with the 33. But really, numbers are neutral, and it's really what you do with it that gives it a charge. So there's nothing wrong with 33. In fact, 33 is a great key into the mysteries if you explore how, why is it that so many things connect with that number, you know? I find it kind of miraculous, and I'm awed by it, but some people find it's an evil number, and they are really against Freemasons, for example, and they kind of, experience kind of a negativity around that. But it's really independent, in my opinion, of the qualities and the number itself.
I think it's interesting to demystify a lot of the numerology, especially the 666, the 33. Scott, let's get back to New York City for a minute. You recently wrote about the structure located at 432 Park Avenue in New York City. It's the tallest residential tower in the Western Hemisphere. Can you break down some of the numerology you researched on this building?
Yes, it is. Let me just look at my notes here. It has each floor plate of that building is 8,640 square feet. And that's interesting because 432 is half of 864, and it falls into a sequence that I call the cosmic sequence. And so when I see that, I sort of my senses get heightened, and I want to figure out if there are more resonances with it. But I counted the windows in the building, and there are 2,016 windows. Again, the digits 2, 1, and 6 are there, which is half of 432. Zero doesn't count really in when you're studying the qualitative aspects of number because it's merely a placeholder. And so that is also part of this canon or cosmic sequence. The total glazed area of all the windows is 201,600 square feet. Again, it uses the digits 216. And for a while, I was mystified about the height of the building. Like, why is it 1,398 feet? Couldn't figure out if that was special or just arbitrary until I divided it by the golden ratio. And it turns out it's 864 times phi, the golden ratio, equals the height of the building. So they've encoded 864 in there and the golden ratio. So it's really amazing. And then the distance from the torch of the Statue of Liberty to the center of the building is 33,333 feet. Again, I'm really just blown away. How is that even possible, you know? but there it is.
On your website, you posted this interesting analysis. You had some really great comments, and I'm not sure if you wrote this, but it was on your site. There's a connection to the Verdi tuning of 432 as opposed to 440, I believe. Can you talk about that significance?
Yeah, I don't know if your listeners are aware of that whole fascinating controversy with music, what is it? The A above middle C, I think it is the 440 hertz, which is called concert tuning, right? Mm-hmm. Well, there was a movement a few years ago about opera singers who wanted to change concert tuning from 440 hertz to 432 hertz. Because when you do that, all of the notes in the opera shift slightly, and they find that it's much more natural for the human voice Actually, you can be a much older opera singer and still hit the notes if everything is tuned to 432 hertz rather than 440. But what's interesting is this building at 432 Park Avenue was rebranded. It used to be a hotel, a different structure, and it had the number 440 Park Avenue. So it's like we went from the concert tuning to the more natural tuning, also with the change of address here on the building. So I see a resonance there as well.
That's amazing. And this is the building, listeners, 432 Park Avenue. It's one of the tallest buildings in New York City. You may have seen it going up in the past few years. Somebody wrote that the distance, and I don't know if this is true, to Cleopatra's Needle from this building is 6,660 feet.
And, oh, wow. I need to check that. That sounds good.
Right. And somebody else wrote, Scott, have you done much work on the 9 code, the fact that the digital root of all these numbers always equal 9? They point out that some of the numbers of the measurements that you use on this building, 206, 2 plus 1 plus 6 equals 9, 72, 7 plus 2 is 9, 108, 1 plus 0 plus 8 mm-hmm. equals 9, and so on. 9 in numerology is the number of ego, is what I understand, because it always returns to itself. What are your thoughts on the number 9 in general in numerology?
Well, it's the highest digit in the decad, because when you go to 10, it's like starting over again at 1 with a placeholder. It's in a new place. So 9 is like the completion of everything. It is the highest principle. And so that's kind of how I see it. It kind of stands alone as the most complete number. And it's beautiful that this so-called cosmic sequence that I mentioned always reduces to 9. So it has this kind of built-in completion in it, this built-in beauty to it.
What do you think is happening when people begin to notice a number repeatedly turning up when they look at a clock or an address or a telephone number?
I think it's like a messaging system, if you will, from a higher or deeper kind of level of reality. And when I start to notice that, I just feel like I'm on the right track. And I'll give you an example that just happened to me the other day. I was in Ireland giving a sacred geometry workshop. I had a lot of jet lag. And in the middle of the night, I woke up once. It was pitch dark. I looked at my phone. It was 3:33. I thought, cool. Right. But then the very next day, the same thing happened to me. And I got up at 3:32. And I just thought, okay, I guess we have a minute of grace, you know?
Or it could be the feathers on the wings of the great seal of the eagle.
Yeah, I think on one wing there's 32, and on the other there are 33. And that's sort of captured in the structure of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, in that an individual can get up to the 32nd degree with all their own work, but then they have to be invited to the 33rd level. It's like an additional level. And so there's something special about 32 and 33 being the absolute completion of it. Yeah, I see that time and time again. I think there's a quote here I've written down by Deepak Chopra. He says, "Synchronicity is God sending us messages anonymously." So I kind of agree with him. There's kind of a messaging system that's sent to you through synchronicity. And one way that can happen is by noticing repetitive digits in your reality.
I was seeing 119 a lot for a while, and I didn't really know what to evaluate there. I even looked at it as a reverse 9/11, in that, oh, everything's fine.
Mm. Oh, I see what you mean. Mm-hmm. It's like the opposite of the emergency, of the mm-hmm. of the cataclysm, the mega ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, certain numbers will stand out to different individuals. I've never been drawn to 119 myself, but I could see why you were, if you feel that it's kind of a reversal of 9/11.
Well, I was trying to look at something positive within it, and without getting too, because when it does show up repeatedly, it is strange. And yeah. And Scott, you mentioned that quote from Deepak Chopra, and I was wondering what your thoughts on the connection with the numeric and geometric coding appearing in urban design, architecture, earth alignment, to the synchronicities that we experience in our personal lives. Does that connect to each other?
Yes, I think that it's really kind of pointing out the nature of reality for those that have eyes to see, that the patterns in the world and the patterns in your personal life are all of kind of the same quality. It brings into focus the idea that the whole world is in consciousness, that consciousness comes first. that everything may very well be imagined in unitive consciousness, not only the world, but your personal life as well. So it gets down to the what I believe is a deep reevaluation of the nature of reality that's available if you'd like to see it that way. Of course, it's totally optional. So it's only there for those who have eyes to see and want to perceive reality in a very different way. I think Carl Jung said, synchronicity is an ever-present reality for those who have eyes to see.
Are you a Freemason?
No, I'm not a Freemason, and I'm not a member of any other fraternities or groups or anything like that. I like to keep an independent perspective.
Have you been contacted by them or invited into any meetings?
I haven't been formally contacted, but there are certain people who are fans of my films who are Freemasons, and I've had some discussions with them. And just been interested in that. And apparently there is a minority of people in Freemasonry who are really truly interested in the mysteries. My take is it's kind of more of a, there's more of a social aspect to it, more of a business aspect to Freemasonry. It could be that a lot of people get into it for those reasons. But still, it's really a minority of people, even in there, that would be really drawn to seek out the mysteries and try to understand reality in the kind of way that I like to do. I'm always kind of been a seeker, and I don't know, maybe there's just a certain small percentage of people who are like that. And whether they're a Freemason or not, doesn't matter.
I think it's interesting that you're touching upon codes within your research, and a lot of these symbols are in Freemason, are embedded in Freemason literature and work, and a lot of the Freemasons maybe these days aren't familiar with that. Maybe the higher level ones are. It's hard to know because these are secret groups. But I was wondering if you stand back and objectively look at your work and see that there's a primary code that you're deciphering in your research.
I probably couldn't boil it down to just one code, but I feel like repetitive digits are one of the keys, and looking at the mathematical constants pi, phi, and e is very important. Studying metrology, the science of measurement seems to be another key. And really just looking at the qualitative aspects of number as opposed to the quantitative that we're used to, but looking at the essence and the feeling behind numbers has really appealed to me. And I'm really kind of in love with sacred geometry in whatever form that takes, whether it's in a city or in a piece of art or even in a crop circle. Geometry, to me, feels like the universal language that transcends culture. And that's my favorite thing to do is to draw with a compass and a straight edge and to kind of initiate others into the mysteries of sacred geometry. I find it's really transformative in an ineffable way. It's really quite beautiful.
It is. It's surprising. You get into the psychedelic realm as well. We didn't really get a chance to touch upon that. But maybe we can in the few remaining minutes of this interview. You do get into the hexagon and the pentagon bond of DMT, dimethyltryptamine, and that we carry that in our brains. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the relationship of 5 and 6 is very important. It's another key, as I'd say, into the mysteries. And DMT has that molecular structure, but so too does serotonin, the molecule associated with states of happiness, and theobromine, the molecule in chocolate. And we all know happiness and chocolate are somehow very related. And DMT is also kind of related to that in that it's a way that can elevate our consciousness in a unique fashion. I've never done it myself, but I'm fascinated to recognize that pattern within the molecules as being similar to some very other interesting molecules.
Yeah, I wonder if Terence McKenna knew about that 6-5 ratio. He must have.
I don't know. I know that there was a guy, what's his name, Eliphas Levi, who is a kind of esoteric author in the 19th century. And he said, let me just look for that. I think I have it here in this document. Yeah, quote, "He who joins the hexagram and the pentagram has solved half of the sacred secret."
Wow.
So there's a guy who knew that marriage of the hexagram and the pentagram is a key into the mysteries.
He knew something. You often see the his famous drawing of Baphomet, right?
Right, yes.
Really good stuff, Scott. What are you doing now, and how can listeners reach out to you and get to learn more about your work?
You can visit secretsinplainsight.com for my films and books on those themes. And I also have a new website called sacredgeometry.academy, which is where I have information about my workshops. I just got back from Ireland where I did a workshop, and it was really amazing. So I'll be posting information there when the next workshop is coming up. And so I invite people to check out those resources.
And you're teaching people how to use sacred geometry in their life?
That's right. How to draw with a compass and a straight edge, and just to allow the geometry to kind of work on you in an ineffable way. It's really quite transformative to work with these pure shapes and to just to be open to whatever comes from them.
Well, Scott Onstott, author of many books, including Taking Measure, Explorations in Number Architecture and Consciousness, thank you very much for being on In Other News.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again Monday, 11 p.m. Visit inothernewsradio.com for more information and archives.
Categories intact, and I had taken LSD, and just it was all going forward. And this thing came upon me like a bolt from the blue, and I came down, and I said, it many times while I was coming down, I cannot believe it. This is impossible. That, friends, right here and now, one quanta away, there is raging a universe of active intelligence that is transhuman, hyperdimensional, and extremely alien. John Lilly talks to, that they play these games with about moral values and setting the constraints of the universe, is not like this god at all. The chief thing about the god of tryptamine, if we can use that, I call it the logos, that's what I think it is, and I make no judgments about it. I constantly engage it in dialogue, saying, you know, well, what are you? Are you some kind of diffuse consciousness which is in the ecosystem of the earth? Trivial to it, and it can show you, you know, you can tune these images. And of course, the question always is independent validation, or at least for a time, for me, the question was. But as I attended more and more conferences like this and realized that the structure of the Western intellectual enterprise is so flimsy at the center that apparently no one knows anything, I became less reluctant to talk about these experiences, because they are experiences. They are primary datum for being. It is, this is not remote, and yet it is so unspeakably bizarre that it casts into doubt all of man's historical assumptions.